From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we have our weekly conversation with Du Boisian scholar and political commentator Professor Anthony Montero from the Saturday Free School in Philadelphia. We spoke with him live via Skype on Thursday. Professor Montero, welcome back. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, Don. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Let's see. We've been discussing a couple of articles that you sent me, one from our good friend and his, Robert Kagan, the husband of the infamous Vicki Newland, the person who I guess had the biggest hand in placing Nazis in control of Ukraine. Kagan is one of the original PNAC gang, I guess, for lack of a better term. He is giving his assessment of the moment in history, along with a couple of other gentlemen of various political persuasions. And maybe we could start with Kagan and work our way into the rest.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. The Robert Kagan article, which appeared in the Washington Post on Sunday, and is a very long I guess from his and his allies' standpoint, cautionary essay. And in it, he argues that the United States is on the cusp of the greatest political crisis since the Civil War. Yeah. Now, Don, you and I have been saying this for about 5 or 6 years, of course, and he sees it now. And what he's arguing is that the stakes are that American democracy, and again, we put air quotes around that, American democracy is at stake, which means actually, in actual terms, that the rule of the oligarchs, the financial and technological hegemons of American society, their political rule is being threatened. And it's being threatened by an angry and, he would say, disloyal mass that could take the 2022 election, take both houses of Congress back, and reelect Trump or somebody like Trump in the 2024 election.
Yep.
And that if the forces of anger and revenge, and he uses the word revenge,
yeah,
are able to take over, able to win, or if they don't win, he says, the possibility of their going to violence, using the pretext that the election in 2024 or even 2022, the congressional senatorial elections, were stolen.
Right.
And this idea of elections that are no longer fair is driving this political crisis, this crisis of rule, this crisis of governance, what we have called a crisis of legitimacy,
yeah,
what V.I. Lenin called the ruling class being unable to rule in the old way.
Yeah. You know, let me just give the audience a couple of chunks of this. The scenario that he envisions is Trump or someone like him is going to run in 2024, and he believes Trump unless they shoot him or whatever. And says that this is going to be the focal point of the crisis, that the amateurish, as he termed it, stop the steal efforts of 2020 have given way to an organized nationwide campaign to make sure that Trump and his supporters control state and local election officials in places that they didn't in 2020. So that these, you know, these interim elections are going to be used as rallying point to elect new secretaries of state, new commissioners of elections, whatever offices are open They're going to be used to position Trump people. So if there's a replay of 2020, they have their hand in the machinery. And the, mm-hmm. and here are some of the things that he finds objectionable. Mm-hmm. It says, Republicans have proposed or passed measures in at least 16 states that would shift certain election authority from the purview of the governor, secretary of state, or other executive branch officers to the legislature. And also in Arizona, it would state that the legislature can, quote, revoke the Secretary of State's issuance or certification of a presidential elector's certificate of election, close quote, by a simple majority vote. And then other states are looking to impose criminal penalties on local officials if they commit what are, he's terming technical infractions, but mean things like obstructing the view of poll watchers. In other words, if they play dirty. Now, this particular area goes right to the heart of the legal problem with the 2020 election, in that mm-hmm. governors, secretaries of state, and others allowed a massive change in the election law in the key swing states that was not approved by the state legislature. And under the U.S. Constitution's Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2, the state legislature is the one who determines the method of electing federal officers, including the president. And so mm-hmm. the one who wants to change the Constitution and who wants to protect those who have been chipping away at it is Kagan and the establishment. They're the ones that are trying to change the Constitution to keep their power.
That's right. I think you're absolutely right. And what they wish to do, and again, you're right about this, is normalize or institutionalize the aberrations, the electoral aberrations of 2020, yep. including unregulated mail-in balloting right. and unregulated early balloting right. and so on. You know, I think that the Kagans and the ruling elite want to have complete control, as he puts it, through executive power
right.
of elections and taking it out of the hands of the people. This is very dangerous, but they see what is coming and it is dangerous for them.
Agreed. So, you know, it appears that, well, first of all, there have been wholesale revisions of the election codes in the states, by the way, that leading into the 2020 election that have nothing to do with COVID or all of these absentee ballots / mail-in ballot and other issues, that actually raised the thresholds for third parties so that it is harder for third-party candidates to even get on the ballot. And in addition to that, there were changes that were made both in the party rules of both the Democratic and Republican parties, and it's odd how this happened at the same time. What a coincidence for these two adversaries to be cooperating like this. Mm-hmm. And moving around primary day and the calendars for running for office so that rather than petitioning, say, in June to get on the ballot for a primary in September, for an election in November, they now start in the winter. And it's all settled by April and May. And they did this last year without any notice to people in the public. So someone like me who pays attention to this stuff had no idea it was happening until right. after it had happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a coup.
Yeah.
That's a coup.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And, oh, yeah, I agree with you completely. And but see, you know, the Robert Kagan article is saying that our election system is under attack, but that is just code language for our political rule is under attack. This is made very clear in Martin Wolf's Financial Times article, where he amplifies and builds upon Kagan's essay, and he says, in effect, that large parts of the American public have broken with the elite. They do not accept the American, quote, American consensus that this is a democracy. In fact, upwards of over 50% are either saying that, quote, democracy is in crisis, or we are not living under a democracy at all. We are living under the rule of a small elite.
Yeah. And Kagan has suggests some of the, well, he's spitballing, apparently, suggests some of the remedies to, you know, he imagines the election in 2024 is resolved, say, against Trump or someone like Trump, again, in the fashion that happened last time. Partisans on both sides are going to end up in the streets, are likely to be better armed, this is what he's saying, and more willing to inflict harm than they were in 2020. And perhaps that's true, by the way. You have four more years of frustration building up. Here's a solution. Would governors call out the National Guard? Would President Biden nationalize the Guard and place it under his control, invoke the Insurrection Act, and send troops into Pennsylvania or Texas or Wisconsin to quell violent protests? Mm-hmm. Deploying federal power in the states would be decried as tyranny and resisted. And he's basically setting a scenario for civil war.
Absolutely.
And his solution is give us complete control over the election system.
That's right. And if you do not, if you challenge once again a federal or presidential election, we will take this as a sign that you are disloyal, and in fact, we will define you as terrorist and go after you as such. Going from what we now call a cold civil war to an actual hot civil war.
Yep.
Dangerous stuff.
You know, now let's think about Kagan in particular for a minute. You know, we can go back to 1997 when he and William Kristol founded PNAC, and they put out a paper that outlined what the United States should be doing. And their advice led to U.S. foreign policy. They ratified somewhat what Clinton was doing already, but it really was like what Bush rolled out, and what everything that's happened since is in accord with PNAC. What is in the world now?
What is PNAC?
I'll let people know. This is the Project for a New American Century.
That's right.
And they came to into existence. It supposedly went out of business in 2006. It was founded in 1997. It had ties to the American Enterprise Institute. That's another gem. Mm-hmm. And they issued a policy document called Rebuilding America's Defenses back in 1997. And so, again, America's military posture in the world and the various defense actions taken to blowing up people on the other side of the world are children of their theory.
That's right. Absolutely.
Situation is their fault, basically. These are the ones who now want to advise us on how to handle the electoral system in our country in a time of crisis.
They were in policy and in ideology preparing the elite for the wars in the Middle East.
That's right.
Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, which is now, we're seeing as a complete debacle. If you recall, Kagan in the Washington Post article references the defeat in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
The very war, one of the wars that he himself called for, and in fact has cost the American people somewhere between $7 and $8 trillion.
Yeah.
And then they want to know why so many Americans don't trust either side with the Build Back America and the $3.5 trillion so-called infrastructure. You know, the people are in disbelief. The system is illegitimate to them. Yep. The elites are illegitimate. There was one poll, I think I mentioned this to you, during the time of Biden's summit with Putin, where more Republican voters saw Putin as positive,
right,
as opposed to Biden.
Right.
9% of Republican voters, or people who voted for Trump, 9% of them see Biden as as a in a positive way, where 19% of them see Putin positively. That is a measure, among others, of a deep crisis of rule. Can the ruling class rule? And that's the big question that Kagan is addressing. That's the question that Martin Wolf amplifies upon with the polling data and the other writer in the Financial Times, whose name's Stephen. Where he says pretty much the same thing. The crisis of the West does not originate from China's growth and development. It originates in internal domestic contradictions of the rule of quote unquote liberal democracy.
Yeah. Yeah. So here's some of the things he's talking about.
You know, Don, you and I guess for now 6 years, you lose track of time. We've been saying the same thing for so long and kind of being in the wilderness saying
right.
it.
Yeah, right.
You know, but have we not been saying this? Have we not said precisely what Kagan and Wolf and others are saying, that the Trump vote, the Trump election victory was the result of a deep crisis domestically? Now, of course, some are looking at this when they do a timeline, that you have to trace the roots of this crisis of legitimacy to the 2008, 2009, some say 2010, financial and economic collapse.
Right. You know, I mean, we've been following the polling data, too. When 8% of the people in the country think that, you know, have confidence in Congress, and Congress has a 98% reelection rate, you know that somewhere in there is an awful lot of deep frustration and anger and apathy and antipathy and suspicion and whatever towards a system that holds itself out as the, you know, gem of the world of democracy that is fundamentally completely negative, like the anti of democracy. If everybody hates Congress and they keep getting reelected almost unanimously, that tells you that the system is a lot of nonsense, that whatever democracy here is virtual and not expressed in the actual process at all. And we've seen this repeatedly. Americans, 10 seconds after the Iraq war started, wanted to be out. They started in polling as against it almost a month after shock and awe. And there was not a candidate that would run for office talking about pulling out of Iraq for years.
That's right.
For years. And the system does not respond to we had millions of people on February 15th in the streets. And it didn't. Not one person got swayed by it in Congress,
except Barbara Lee.
Well, Barbara. Actually, this was after Barbara Lee. That was her vote. She voted that way in October of 2002. She was the only one that voted at that time that way. But for example, she didn't join in the litigation that was brought by Conyers and Kucinich against Obama for violating the War Powers Act in 2011. There were 10 members of Congress that did that, and she was not one of them. And there are others. There are other tells like that. It's one thing to be allowed to. It's another, social Democrat move. It's one thing to be allowed to vote against going to war when you're the only one, because you're the establishment's hedge in there. When the public comes around and they're looking to get to somebody who has bona fides as an anti-war person, you're the one. You got it, so they get behind you. And then you do what they do everywhere. They walk. You go to the table with, you know, conceding 98% of what the other side wants.
Absolutely.
And then fight over the 2%, and people get bloodied over it, and they don't even get the 2%.
And for us who are political activists, it's a cautionary tale. That when you get to the the Congress of the United States or the Senate or the presidency or politicians, period, none of them can be trusted to carry out the will or the interest of the people.
Yeah. The ones that are actually intending to do that, I mean, you can't trust any of them, but the ones that you actually would be able to trust, they're gone. They're vetted before they get there, and if they sneak they're out like Cynthia McKinney and Dennis Kucinich and others, or their plane goes down, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen that, too, with a certain senator from Minnesota. So, and you know, this is, of course, replicated across the board. If you happen to be Secretary General of the United Nations and you're trying to get the imperialists out of Congo, your plane goes down too, doesn't it?
That's right. But, you know, this is a classic chickens coming home to roost situation.
For sure.
Now, and this is what Wolf and this is what Kagan and all of them are saying. The real problem of the rule of the American hegemons, the American empire, is not somewhere overseas. It's right here in the United States.
Yep.
And as things stand at this point, few, if any, have been swayed by the Biden presidency and its claim to build back better and all of that mess.
Right.
Because now we see in his polling numbers, he's down in the 40s, kind of where Trump was after Trump had been savaged ruthlessly by the media and the establishment. At least he held on to something in the 40s.
Right.
And while Biden is being celebrated and so on by the media and the establishment, he's down where Trump was. So, it doesn't look good for the ruling elite.
Yeah, Trump actually outpolled him this past week, you know, by like 2 points or something, but, you know, significant, not just margin of error. And again, Trump got carpet bombed by the media, surveilled and harassed by the CIA and FBI, the FISA courts, and the entire institutional architecture. Half the population, because, you know, he's a Republican, or because he's Trump, because they were whipped up to do that. And after all of that, his support was 48 or 49% when he left. He honestly lost that election, it was a squeaker, okay? That all by itself is remarkable. And
no
what it
question.
Does is it marks exactly what you're saying, that there's deep set, not just suspicion, but a rejection, in essence, of the institutions and of the deliverers of news from on high.
That's right. That's right. And you know, this comes at a time, I mean, just expanding or broadening our view of all of this, when the World Economic Forum and Klaus Schwab, and we see it in practice these days, is talking about a great reset of capitalism, a rebranding of capitalism, where now the ruling class is viewed as woke and the working class is reactionary. And woke means literally accepting the rebranding images, the rebranded images of a capitalist system, an imperial system in crisis. The people reject it. So what do? They put a black face on it. Give us more black people. Oh, look, we have black people on cable news, and they're talking about racism and white supremacy. And in the New York Times, we have the 1619 Project. We have moved to the post-racial paradise. And it's all because of the tech giants, Facebook, and the financial oligarchs who have awakened to see that racism does not serve all of that nonsense.
Right.
When in fact, the crisis of the working people, their impoverishment, their distress is deepening. I live in a city, as you know, and this city is a tale of three cities. And the masses of people are doing worse now than they were 40 years ago.
You look at all of the objective numbers. You take a look, first of all, the Washington Post itself said in 2020, the black and white economic divide is as wide as it was in 1968. Now, that is after 8 years of a black president. If you look at actual wealth, look at that black wealth in, say, 2000, and then look at it now. It's almost half now what it was 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's the result of the 2008 financial crisis where so many lost their homes. And if I could just say one thing, you see, when you break those numbers down just in terms of race, it distorts it.
That's
because
right.
Because there is a great concentration of wealth among white oligarchs.
That's right.
That does not account for the mass of poverty among the white working
That's
class.
Exactly right.
Which is more similar to the situation of the black working class. In Philadelphia, the fastest rise in poverty is among white working people.
That's right.
You now see almost an equal numbers of black and white, or percentages of black and whites in poverty in the city of Philadelphia.
Yep.
I mean, we're dealing with a situation of class decline, of class distress, of class impoverishment. And just to talk about the racial numbers does not tell the whole story.
In fact, it masks it.
That's absolutely.
Because now the solution looks like to expropriate every white person that you see and split their stuff in half with every black person that you see, except for one problem. Where's that going to come from? Because the people who actually have the wealth are not sitting at the table. We don't even know who they are, half of them.
That's right. And, you know, it feeds into this settler colonialist narrative. Or the 1619 Project, where the white working class is responsible for the crisis of everyday living of black folk. And so you close the door to the unity of those who suffer equally or similarly from the rule of monopoly capitalists.
I think that at least personally for me, the dialectic, thesis, antithesis, synthesis is, you know, at the heart of Marxist, you know, thought, whatever, philosophy. The most salient part to me of Marx and what he borrowed from Hegel and what others further developed is the fact of the difference between appearance and essence. This period we are in now shows that contradiction in the greatest relief that's ever been seen in history, not even like multiple orders of magnitude. Because most people spend a good part, maybe half their lives, living in a virtual world, looking at television or their phone or whatever, and not even seeing the actual person that they're talking with. All of the forces of society that govern are commerce, jobs, or cultural activity, social activity, all of those things happen outside of our view. We only interact with what is shown to us and what is immediately adjacent to us, and we are therefore the most propagandized and most ignorant in terms of our relationship to reality of any people in history. And unfortunately, we're out of time, and so I got to say thanks a lot, and we'll speak more next week, Tony. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.